history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you. There are men and women who, if you take the time to listen to their stories, you're going to be amazed at the things they've done for the sake of our freedom. Each week, we visit with members of our greatest generation. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. Along the way, we're educated, we're entertained, oftentimes inspired. Oh, yeah, I did say entertained, didn't I? Well, maybe you've been entertained by this gentleman a time or two, and you didn't even realize it. If you saw him on the street, you might not realize who he is and what he meant to you in your childhood. So let's listen to this and see if it rings a bell.
There's a little duck named Yakky Doodle, and his best friend is Chopper, a great big bulldog. Fibber Fox or someone I'm talking about now in the Yogi Bear show. Someone's chasing him down the road, and he calls to Chopper. Chopper tells him to run. He gets there, and when he does arrive, Chopper says, "Well, now you're safe, Yakky. Where is your mama?" And he always looked up sadly and said, "I don't have no mama. Would you be my mama? Only you'll remember it this way."
"Help! Chopper! Chopper, you're after me!"
"Run, little feller!"
"I'm running."
"Yakky, now that you're safe, tell me, where is your mama?"
"I don't have no mama. Would you be my mama?"
"I can't imagine I did that 53 years ago for Hanna-Barbera. Paul, how you doing? This is Jimmy Weldon."
I don't know if we've ever had an introduction quite like that on Hometown Heroes. That is something, and I'm sure you rang a lot of bells for a lot of people. How do you still do those voices at 92 years old?
"Well, just barely making it. You heard that. I always often tell, I say, Yakky, you don't sound like you used to. But, Paul, you're from Fresno. I spent most of my time on radio in Fresno, and up there I always had a show called Webster Webfoot. That was a little duck that I had on television. And so when Hanna-Barbera saw me on the air, they said, they called me and said, would you do the voice of a little duck in a new series we've got? And I said, yeah. Had no idea what it would mean, but little Yakky Doodle has meant more for my career than anything I ever did. Of course, it is Webster's voice.
I'm the star.
Okay, don't do any more, Webster. But anyway, they do recognize Yakky Doodle more than little Webster. But I'll bet you remember Webster when you were a little boy, don't you? Are you? Well, no, you're not even old enough. You weren't even born then. Good gracious, I forgot. Yeah, this is back in 1952, 3 and 4. I was up there in 56, 7, 8, and then went back in 59, was there till 68 in Fresno on Channel 47.
Mm-hmm. You know what my first television job was? Channel 47.
Oh, golly.
And we're going to learn today the history behind Webster Webfoot and Yakky Doodle and where it all came from. And we're going to learn that it might never have happened if you didn't make it through World War II. And, yeah. I don't know how someone has the creativity to come up with all that and go back and forth from one voice to the other. It's an amazing talent that you have that you still have at 92. And I want to find out where it came from. But let's go way back.
All right.
You're born in Texas, but grow up in Oklahoma.
Yeah, Chickasha, Oklahoma. Paul, forgive me for interrupting you because here, that's my mind, the way it works. This will be the 38th year in a row that I'm speaking at Pepperdine University, a program called Youth Citizenship Seminar that was opened by Dr. Charles Runnels. He's the chancellor. Every year, he selects about 175 young people from Southern California. They get one full week at Pepperdine University, Malibu campus. Speakers from all everywhere come in and talk to these young people. It's about American free enterprise system indoctrination. And so after the first one of the professors heard me speak. This is on a Saturday morning because they arrive at Monday morning and they're there till Friday night when they have the banquet. And so the next day, he heard me speak at a club. Went back and said, "Charles, I found one of our speakers for next year." And he said, "Who's that?" He said, "Jimmy Weldon." "I don't know him." He said, "Well, you will. Have lunch with him." So we were having lunch, and Dr. Runnels said, "Do you have any idea why I asked you to have lunch with me?" And I said, "No, But to be sitting here with the Chancellor of Pepperdine University is certainly a real honor. He told me what it was, and he said, would you be willing to speak at our seminar? And I said, does a bear live in the woods? And that was 37 years ago. Anyway, I enjoy it so much. My passion today is talking to young people about America. I did a thing that was used on the USS Kennedy in the Persian Gulf during the Iraq War for 4,500 sailors. It's a flag, a tribute to our flag.
I've seen the video of you doing this, and it's powerful, and I'm glad you're bringing that up because I want all our folks to hear it. Do you want to do it now, or you want to save it for them?
If you don't care, I would do it.
Go for it.
All right, okay. I want you to imagine that you're looking at a flag, standing there, and I'm out in the audience, and I'm going to walk up to the flag and hold it, and not even look at the audience until I say the end. And here it is. I am the flag of the United States of America, conceived in the dreams of liberty and the hopes of freedom. I was designed by the hands of Betsy Ross, and her sewing basket was my cradle. Though I was never an orphan, I was adopted by the Continental Congress in 1777 and proclaimed the national emblem of a nation, newly born on this continent, fighting valiantly for survival and destined to bring to all mankind a new concept in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I rode with Ethan Allen, the Green Mountain Boys, at the Battle of Fort Bennington. I was flown above the decks of Old Ironsides and the mass of Yankee Clippers. I blazed the trail with Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett. I led the settlers coming west and crossed Death Valley in a covered wagon. Once I fell to the ground at Custer's last stand at the Little Bighorn, there were no living hands left to pick me up. But I galloped up the slopes of San Juan Hill with Colonel Teddy Roosevelt and his Rough Riders in the United States Cavalry. I was carried through the halls of Montezuma onto the shores of Tripoli by the United States Marine Corps. I stayed with the boys till it was over there on the battlefields of the Marne, Chateau Thierry, St. Mihiel, and the Argonne Forest. I saw many of the youth and manhood of our nation fall and lie still in death that given their last full measure of blood. The war was over for them forever, but I kept my lonely vigil over their graves and stayed to watch the poppies growing into crosses row on row in Flanders Field. I was raised by 6 brave Marines and sailors during the hell of Iwo Jima in the final hours of World War II. Haven't changed much, 239 years. I still have my original 13 stripes, but as each state came in the Union, a new star was proudly added to the constellation of my blue field. Start with 13. Now they're 50. I've draped the caskets of our nation's heroes and borne to their last resting place the bodies of presidents, generals, admirals, humble privates, and the unknown soldier. Wherever free men gather, wherever there's justice, equality, faith, hope, charity, truth, and brotherly love, there too am I. When you stand with your hand over your heart and recite the Pledge of Allegiance to me, don't merely mouth the words, but think of what they mean to you, and mean what you say. And when you come to the phrase, One Nation Under God, remember it matters not what your religious belief. It only matters that you hold your faith dear, that you practice it daily, and that you preserve it forever. History will never write my obituary. For I am the stars and stripes forever. I'm Old Glory. I'm your flag. I am you. I did that for the Burbank Middle School. The little boy in the back of the room said, that never happened when I told him I was with Patton's 3rd Army Combat Engineers at Liberated Booking Wall Concentration Camp. When he said that, I just screamed out, don't say that! I was there! He backed up against the wall. Later, I talked to the largest Lions Club in Long Beach. When I mentioned this, a little man came out of the audience with a yarmulke on the back of his head, and he said, Jimmy, I'm Rabbi Cade. I was at Booking Wall Concentration Camp. We stood there hugging and crying in the middle of the room. Later, he had a program called Survivors of the Holocaust and had me speak. He introduced me. He said, I'm here because Jimmy's here. That's one reason. I said, don't say that, Rabbi. But it did make me feel good, and I called my dear friend in Palm Springs, Dennis Daly. He was the top writer for United Press International over 20 years. This is the largest news organization in the world. It doesn't even exist anymore. It's gone. But I said, Dennis, what's happening to our country? He said, what do you mean? I told him what happened about that little boy, saying that never happened. He said, you got to get a 501c3 nonprofit corporation and talk to schools. I got a what? He said, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. And it angered me. I thought, well, doggone, just because I don't know what you're talking about, don't make a fool out of me. Didn't stop him. A year and a half later, the IRS in Washington and a California legislator gave me a 501c3 nonprofit corporation entitled Center for Youth Patriotism. And this is a motto statement that Dennis Daly wrote. To instill in California youth a sense of civic, nonpartisan pride and a better understanding of our common heritage through the use of visual, non-visual programs and personal appearances. And I thought, golly, now I can talk to schools and tell children about America. But the biggest honor, Paul, came when I talked to the military order of world wars. General Dan Pemberton walked up to me with a $100 bill in his hand. He put it out and he said, Jimmy, put this in your little foundation with a promise to me. I said, sir. He said, promise me you won't stop talking to young people about America. I said, General. He said, promise me. And I said, I will, sir. Walked away with a tear in his eyes. So now when I'm speaking to these young people, I sit down, I look in the audience, I said, let me tell you something. You own this country. Those people in Washington work for us. We don't work for them. If you find something that's not in the Constitution, question it, because they're trying to rewrite history. I can't believe it. I'm 92 years old. Check the curriculum, what it says here. Our government is all-powerful. You obey every order that's given. That's exactly the opposite of what I was taught as a young man in school. So when we close with our hands together in prayer, I've had administrators come up and say, Jimmy, thank you for praying for our students. We can't do this. I think, what do you mean? What has happened? This is an important time in our history. This election is going to mean so much. So everybody, I pray that you'll study the people who love this country. And let's get those people back in Washington, going to the days when our founding fathers wrote those sacred documents, the Declaration of Independence and our Constitution. Hey, Paul, I'm sorry. I just got rambling. Can't stop. Forgive me.
I don't think anyone's complaining, Jimmy.
God bless you.
I wish they were all sitting here with me and could see the emotion in your face, but I know they hear it in your voice. They hear and they feel your passion for America and what it stands for. And I'm sure they were at rapt attention as you went through that flag presentation that you've done at so many places. And I bet you'll have some more bookings after everybody hears you here.
Oh, God.
I hope so.
Thank you.
And I'll have that information at hometownheroesradio.com if you want to connect with Jimmy and the Center for Youth Patriotism.
Right now it's time for our first commercial break. When we come back, we're going to find out how a boy from Oklahoma ended up in Hollywood by way of World War II's European theater. And it's all just so much more captivating when the story's being told by a guy like Jimmy Weldon. Pull up the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and some powerful videos of Jimmy. And keep it here because Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 92-year-old Jimmy Weldon of Burbank, California. Born in Texas, he grew up in Oklahoma, served in Europe during World War II with the 1270th Engineer Combat Battalion. He also served as the voice of Yakky Doodle, the adorable little duck from the Yogi Bear show. And if you caught the beginning of our program today, you found out he can still do that voice at age 92. He also makes frequent appearances as a motivational speaker. Go to jimmyweldon.com if you'd like to book him, or I also have the links up for you at hometownheroesradio.com. The Center for Youth Patriotism is his nonprofit.
And I want to talk more about that, but I think it'd be interesting. I think our listeners would be interested to get your story and know where all of this came from, because clearly, you're an amazing man with amazing energy and amazing talents, still going strong at 92. But take me back there. Take me back there to Oklahoma as a boy during the Great Depression. What was your life like back then?
Oh, Paul, thank you for saying that. I was 7 years old. I'm always talking about motivation. Key to success is motivation, having something to do. I wrote a book called Go Get 'Em, Tiger. And in this book, I always say, have a reason for getting out of bed, some reason for being. When I talk to AARP people my age, I say, I greet you in the name of insurance actuary tables. We're all dead. They look at me and I say, wait a minute, we're all going to die. I was supposed to die 8 years ago. I want to tell you how to live. And they think, golly, that's different. But anyway, I tell these young people, plant a goal in your mind. Don't let anyone ever talk you out of it. The most important decision you ever make is planting a goal and deciding what you want to do. Secondly, to the commitment to your God. God's most important, but then second, be sure and know what you want to do. Have a reason, like I said. I was 7 years old when my two brothers took me to a movie, 10 Nights in a Bar Room. Now imagine a little seven-year-old boy going to a movie like that where the town drunk is a star, and he's always at the saloon drinking, and his little daughter, 3 years old, walks through the swinging door every day and say, Daddy, will you come home with me? Like Foster Brooks, yeah. And this one day, she walked through the door and called to her dad to come to him, and the bartender's having a fight with him. He threw a bottle of beer at him, and he ducked and hit this little girl in the head, and I screamed, Mama! Mama! My two brothers had to take me home. Remember, Paul, I'm 92, but this was 85 years ago. I tell young people, remember, this computer of ours, our brain, is the most powerful piece of equipment that's ever designed. Everything you've ever seen, thought of, or done is in this computer. Not for instant recall, because people like my age, we have senior moments. One guy said, the other said, I can't remember your names. You can't. No, but I don't worry, because at our age, we lose millions of brain cells every day. We do. Yeah, your name is in one of those I just lost. But anyway, back again, when I was that little boy, I can see that now. I was sitting on the floor crying, and I said, Mama, he killed that little girl. She said, what little girl? I said, Mama, saw him, he killed her. She said, babe, what are you talking about? And I tried to explain. Moving, she said, no, that was play-like. I said, play-like? Mama, I saw the blood in her head. And she said, no, that's probably ketchup. Well, as a seven-year-old boy, I said, okay, I can understand that. But then when she said, they probably gave her some milk and cookies after they did that scene. I remember sitting on the floor looking up at her, and I said, Mama, if it's me, I'd want some vanilla wafers. She said, probably have those in Hollywood too, babe. Paul, never did I ever dream I would write a book one day called Go Get 'Em, Tiger. And the first chapter is the witnessed murder. Mama, he killed that little girl. What little girl? Mama, I saw him, he killed her. Babe, what in the world are you talking about? Almost 64 years have raced by since that little seven-year-old boy made those disturbing statements to his mother, who knelt down and tenderly wrapped her arms around him. had no idea what she's going to say would crystallize my future. Yes, I was that little boy. Paul, God's blessed me in so many ways you can't imagine. I've spoken to more National Mannerism Association chapters than any speaker in the United States. I used to go all over everywhere. All these CEOs say, put on paper what you tell our people. I said, I just barely got out of high school. I don't care. Write it down. So I did write it. Mm-hmm. But then, anyway, that's my chapter in my first book. The only one I've got, first chapter.
Well, maybe you should write another one.
No. They've asked me that. I couldn't. But anyway, from that moment, I wanted to be an actor. And I knew one day I was coming to Hollywood, California, heard a little boy going, oh, boy, oh, boy, one day. And I said, hey, that sounded like Donald Duck. What do you think it's supposed to sound like? I don't know. I tried to imitate him. I couldn't make the sound. But finally, one morning, I went, that's it. Out the side of my mouth. Then I tried so hard to speak. Finally, 12 years old, I answered my teacher in school one day. She asked me something. I said, yes, ma'am, that's right. I had to stay in after school. On our 50th anniversary, our high school reunion, she walked up to me and she said, do you remember when I made you stay in after school for talking that duck talk to me? I said, yes, ma'am, Miss Bailey. She said, I was always afraid I might have inhibited you. I said, you really hurt me. I'd answer the phone.
Hello?
If it's one of my brother's friends, I'd say,
great to see you.
And they'd grab the phone. Mama, don't let him answer the phone. He's crazy. He embarrasses. But anyway, that's where it all started when I was a little boy.
So you started the duck talk as
that's
a little
it.
Boy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you said you wanted to be an actor from that point on, huh?
Yes. I knew what I wanted to do. And that's why I said, plant a gold in your mind. Don't let anybody ever talk you out of it. Because all of us are different. And when I speak somewhere like at Pepperdine, I'll say, how, what do you want to do? One of them say, I want to be an attorney. What do you want to do? I want to be a doctor. I want to be a so-and-so. And I say, you see all the difference? We're all different. Then I say, you are the most important person in the world. You know more about yourself than all the people in the world combined. And you're the only person you're never going to leave. So it's up to you. You can do anything you want to if you believe you can. My business card, Paul, at the top says Mark 9:23, if thou canst believe, all things are possible to him that believeth. We had a carpenter that used to walk on the streets of Galilee. He said time and time again, as ye believe, so shall it be done unto you. It's so simple, we don't even realize it.
Mm-hmm.
All we have to do is just ask.
I'm curious, with the Great Depression in Oklahoma, a lot of folks moved west. You know, in those times. Was life hard? Was it hard to get by? Did you guys have to get by with less than you wanted?
We didn't know what it was to not have something. We just didn't have it. Mm-hmm. My mom was, oh, how great. We had overalls, the little bib overalls that you put on, but they were always clean. Mom made sure that we were dressed clean. My dad had a service station, and he had to stay open 7 days a week, and it killed him because he wanted to go to church, but they made him stay open. A lot of my little friends didn't even know him unless they saw him with that Texaco uniform on. He had one suit, and he wore that when we could go to church together. But answering your question, you know, like I say, all of us, we didn't know what it was not to be poor. We just didn't know what it was.
Mm-hmm.
But Dad used to laugh, said, my family has 3 meals a day, oatmeal, cornmeal, and miss-a-meal.
That's pretty good.
But let me give you something about my father. This you'll like. We used to say, Dad, we love you, and Mom, we owe you so much. And Dad looked at us and said, you owe us nothing. We owe you everything. Said, you're uninvited guests into this world. You didn't ask to be born. We asked for you.
Mm-hmm.
If you do something good, we can hold our heads up proudly and say, those are our boys. But if you do something ugly, we have to bow our head and ask forgiveness because we didn't teach you right. Now, what kind of parent says that today? Isn't that amazing?
A humble one with a lot of perspective.
Yeah, Dad, what a great man.
I guess so.
I know you're thinking about the war, and I was going to say, when I graduated, I was 17, and man, December, look, think about it. It was in 1941 when it all started.
Mm-hmm.
And so my two brothers were drafted in the war, and then when I had to go, I was the baby of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I went in the combat engineer, 1st Division in Camp Swift, Texas, 146 combat engineers. It was a brand new battalion. And since it was so new, I got to make sergeant in the first 3 months that I was in the Army.
I got to ask you, before we get too far along in that, I bet your memory is so clear and so strong, as everyone can hear. I've got to believe you remember December 7th, 1941, and where you were and how you heard that news.
Oh, yeah, just, oh, golly Moses, not possible. December 7th, 1941, it's almost like when I remember Kennedy when he was shot.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, well, we couldn't believe it. We said, what it is, I'm just thinking, 1941, graduated from high school, just barely going, and we were kind of didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
The news was going on, but there's no such thing as TVs, you know.
Yeah.
But we were all just, we heard rumors of this, that, and the other, and when that happened, it was like, golly, what's going on?
Shocked your system a little bit.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And what did your, so you had two older brothers?
Yeah.
What did they end up doing in the service?
Well, my oldest brother, Joe, was a crew chief for bombardiers.
All right.
And he worked on airplanes. The middle brother was in the Air Force. He wanted to go be a pilot. We both wanted to be pilots. But he didn't take the examination because he was afraid I might not be able to pass the examination. That's my middle brother.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't go in the Air Force because he thought, well, if my baby brother can't go, I'm not going to go.
Huh.
When the combat engineers took the Air Force examination, passed it, and called him, and he took it, and he went straight into the air from there. But
he didn't do it till you did it.
That's right. He waited for me. Oh, golly.
Well, and I know we're bouncing around here. So you told us you're in the engineers at Camp Swift, and then you find out that you can take this examination to qualify for flight training.
Went to Northfield, Vermont, Max, and qualified for bombardier pilot and navigator. 3 days before pre-flight at Maxwell Field, Alabama, we were down there ready to go, and the Battle of the Bulge took place, and 36,000 of us were taken out immediately and gone back to our respective ground and service forces.
Mm-hmm.
I had to go back in. This time I was in the 1270th Combat Engineers.
And clearly the reason, and people who know their history can put two and two together, but the Battle of the Bulge, the reason that changed so much is there's so many casualties.
Right.
They need bodies to replace the bodies who
That's
are no
it.
Longer able.
Yes.
So all your ambitions of flying for our country are gone, and you're back in the engineers, and then they tell you you're heading overseas?
Yes. Yes, went straight over there, landed at Weston-super-Mare, England, stayed there for a little training, and went to Le Havre, France, went where we went in.
Mm-hmm.
Joined Patton's Stern Army, combat engineers. Man, No, I can't say it. Yeah, I can. Did you see Patton?
Sure.
Remember when he says, "Rommel, you magnificent son of a... read your book!" Remember that line?
Yeah.
Man, that was him. Man, he didn't want to stop. He wanted to go right straight into Russia right now.
Yeah, he did. Yep. And there are some interesting theories about that. Did you ever see him? Did you ever come across him?
No. Well, just faintly, because we were moving all around. We were ahead building pontoon bridges and clearing minefields. That's what happened. But when he had those Pearl-Handled pistols,
yep,
he wasn't saying, "You all going up there, I'll be there later." He'd say, "Come on, gang." He was up there in the front. Boy, a powerful man.
He had a gift of leadership and motivation, and certainly we know,
yes,
that's one of your gifts as well. But your task at the time as this young guy out of Oklahoma was, as you said, building pontoon bridges and clearing minefields.
We went through things, places, Paul, that the infantry hadn't even gone through because we were ahead of them getting things done. People look out the window, who are these guys? What are they doing coming here? We were going so fast, we were 10 miles from the Czech border when the war ended.
Well, we don't want to go too fast and miss anything important, so let's catch our final break right here. If we run out of time, we're going to continue this one into our next episode because we have one pretty phenomenal storyteller with us today, don't we? Jimmy Weldon, 92 years old, of Burbank, California. Maybe you remember him as the voice of Yakky Doodle or even Webster Webfoot. Check out the photos and videos on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page and at hometownheroesradio.com. And we'll be right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's RV country within driving distance of this radio station. But really, it doesn't matter where you live, because Paul Everett has a fly and buy program that will fly you to any of his locations to buy your new RV. It's one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Serving RVers for 55 years, you'll find Paul Everett's RV country throughout the West and online at rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to talk to 92-year-old Jimmy Weldon. If you grew up in Dallas, Texas, or in one of a few different places in California, maybe you remember him on television as Uncle Jimmy Weldon and his friend Webster Webfoot. Maybe you're more of a Yaki Doodle fan from the Yogi Bear cartoon. That was Jimmy, too. But during World War II, he was sent overseas with the 1270th Combat Engineer Battalion. And in so many ways, it changed his life, as we're going to hear.
Everybody seems to have a welcome to the war moment, if you will. A spot where you say, oh, this is what it's really like. Was there a moment like that for you where you realized that what you were doing was potentially dangerous and hazardous to your health?
I think we were too young. We were just going, whatever they said. Let's go. Come on, guys.
But I mean, when I hear clearing minefield, I mean, that doesn't sound like an adventure to me. That sounds like, uh-oh, if I make a wrong step or poke the wrong spot, I might die.
Well, right, but at that point, we were so carefully taught things to do that we didn't think about that.
What was that process like? What would you guys do if you had an area of land that they say there may still be mines in here and you have to remove them or disable them? How would that work?
I had all kinds of ways of going through it. But mainly, our stuff was still building the pontoon bridges and things like this.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll never forget when we went through Buchenwald concentration camp and we saw these people laying on these wooden slabs, reaching out under there trying to say, thank you for helping us. We thought, I can't believe this. It's not possible. We walk on through the barracks and we go out in the back and there are cubicles back there in the back. Hundreds of bodies nude laying in these cubicles just like they've been thrown out like you would with cattle or something, waiting to be cremated. We thought, this is not possible. That will I'll never forget.
Mm-hmm.
But
had you ever, before you got there to Buchenwald, had you ever heard of this idea of a concentration camp? Did you know that the Jews were being exterminated and tortured and treated the way they were?
Well, we heard it, but it didn't register, because it's like a lot of people didn't even know this when they lived very close to it, because they kept it away from everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You just young. See, again, we're young kids, and we're in the army. We're going. We tried to do have as much fun as we could, even though it was strictly, you never know what's going to happen.
And you alluded a moment ago to that air of invincibility, or that bravado of youth that says, hey, it might happen to somebody else, but it's not going to happen to me.
Yes. Yeah.
That said, in your time overseas, did you ever have that thought, I might not make it back home to America?
No.
Not once?
No. Can't remember that.
Did you feel that you had some kind of protection that was going to bring you home?
Well, yeah, faith. You got that. That's the only thing. I had so much deep faith that I've never lost.
Mm-hmm.
That means more than it kills me when someone doesn't even have any faith of any kind. At my age, you think, oh, golly. I was married to a little English girl for 40 and a half years.
Mm-hmm.
After the war was over, I stayed in England, went to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts. Can you imagine me? How now, brown cow? You all. But I went and I met her at the Stage Door Canteen, which was like for over here, and Rainbow Corner is called. And every week I'd put on a show for the soldiers, mm-hmm, all over where I met Muriel. Then we started going. I met her mother and dad, and I said, I'd like for her to come to America. And so we tried to make arrangements for me to come to America, but I didn't have a job or anything. She couldn't come. They wouldn't let her come over with me. So, but I came over by myself. A year and a half later, Dad had to post a $500 bond to get her over here, because I didn't have any money anyway. But I promised him, I said, if you let Muriel come to America and she likes my family, we'll get married. If she doesn't, I'll send her home. Nobody's hurt. But if we do get married, we're going to stay married, and I'll see she gets home. Well, they thought, that's fine. Once she leaves, she'll forget about him. But she came over a year and a half later. We were married September the 26th, 1947. She went home 39 times during the next 40 and a half years we were married. I brought her mother over here twice, her mother and dad once. And they said, you kept your promise.
I guess so. And I want to explore more of that. And I know, again, we're going in and out here, but I want to make sure I capture all of this, too. So you mentioned the concentration camp. And my grandfather was there at Buchenwald, and I heard his stories, and it haunted him for years. I mean, he had nightmares and flashbacks of some of the things he experienced there. What was the biggest impact of that experience on you, of what you saw, what you heard, what you witnessed there?
Well, the engraved in my mind is our going through the barracks. Just really to see these people, to think, I can't believe here. They're just there laying on those wooden slabs. Just enough room to slide in and out. And then I remember seeing one man when we went in the back in one place. He was just sitting there, the little face looking like, I don't know what's happening. He was just alone sitting there, and I thought, golly, I couldn't talk to him or anything. There's no way. No way. Couldn't. But those are the things that are in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
That I wouldn't want to forget either. But
sounds like it was appalling to you, but also just shocking to know that people could be treated that way.
That's right. That's it. I'll never forget our platoon sergeant when he stood there and started crying, and I thought, golly Moses, powerful guy. But it was through such like I can't. What's happened? Why? What are we seeing? What are we seeing here? We're going through things. We're doing things that are not as close to this. And I think, well, that was it. We were fortunate in the sense that I missed a lot of that. When we were doing our work, we were kind of by ourselves. But when you see the things like concentration camps, yeah, it's at 92, I'm still thinking it's almost a dream.
Mm. But you described for us an incident in a classroom where you're speaking and someone tells you it didn't happen, and that rose up righteous anger in you to set him straight. And you also talked about a rabbi in the back of the room who had been a child.
Yes.
At Buchenwald. I can't imagine what that felt like
to meet
him in that setting.
Oh, listen, it knocked me out. And later I did a program with thing called SpurdVac we have over here. It's the Society for Preservation of Early Radio Vaudeville. And we were sitting at a table, and I was telling them about this. And the person in that group said, "Jimmy, Rabbi Kane was our rabbi." I said, was. He said, "Yeah, he passed away 6 months ago," and it just knocked me out because I just said, "Oh, golly," because we became such good friends.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you think, there it is. Look, Nancy Reagan died. It happens.
And a lot of times history dies with people, including a lot of World War II veterans who don't talk about what they did. And I'm just thinking about your story. If you're in a minefield and something goes off, we might have you. We might not have ever had these characters you do. You wouldn't have met your wife in England and all of that.
Yeah.
But about a month after the liberation of Buchenwald, Nazi Germany surrenders, VE Day. Was that a big day for you?
Oh, yes. Yes, you talk about dancing in the streets. We couldn't even imagine such a thing. Oh, golly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the other question that comes to mind, people are thinking, okay, if he has this much energy at 92, what was he like at 21 or maybe even younger than that? When you were overseas in the Army, were you entertaining? I know afterwards you told us in England, but while you're actually with this engineer outfit, were you doing some of these voices or entertaining your fellow soldiers?
Every time they had someone come over that was a celebrity, they would put a program, and I did the MC. I was MC of the program and did something. And when the war was over, Colonel Connors, who was our battalion commander, called me, and he said, I want you to go into Chafe headquarters, General Eisenhower. He went over and he said, this fellow should have been in the entertainment industry, entertainment department of the Army all of his career. He said, so we're going to move him into here.
Mm-hmm.
And I went into Chafe headquarters, and that's where I spent the last few weeks in the Army before I went to the Royal Academy. We were sitting there, and one of the guys said, are you going to stay over here and go to school? I said, no, I'm not going to school. I'm an actor. I'm going to Hollywood. He said, well, why don't you stay here and go to school? I said, I don't want to go to school. And he said, well, why don't you just look at what we have? I said, give me the list. Let me have it. I saw all these great universities things. I got into the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts. I said, that's the one I want to go to. They said, you got the only one and you couldn't get in. I said, give me a pass. I went over to London and met Sir Kenneth Barnes, who was the head of the Royal Academy. And I said, Sir Kenneth, I got to come to this school. I told him a story about when I was a little boy and about how I cried and said, Mama, he killed that guy. I said, I've got to be an actor. He said, by Jove, I'll accept you. And that's why I went to Royal Academy. Can you imagine that?
Backtracking again, when you say that you emceed any time one of these USO shows and a celebrity would come by, who are some of those names?
Mickey Rooney came in, and he and I had the same birthday. He died. He was just 3 years older than I am. But I let him use my gun that Dad sent me overseas because I wanted to have a sidearm. I had a 45,
mm-hmm.
and Mickey Rooney wore it in the play that he did when he came over. We talked about it later when he came out to Hollywood. Never thought I'd see him again.
Mm-hmm.
But Red Skelton, I emceed his program at Camp Swift when he did a program. He used to go around. Any of the celebrities that came out, they'd say, get Shin. That's my name. I mean, right. Jimmy
Weldon. Weldon's a Hollywood name.
That's it.
But
it was because of my oldest brother. Uh-huh. And the middle one, that's how I got their name. I took their names.
So who, your oldest brother?
Yeah,
was...
I was overseas. We were in had just gone into France.
Mm-hmm.
And he got this letter from Mom and Dad, and they said, Bub and Betty had a little boy, and they wanted to name him Jimmy Weldon. And he said, Bub, my oldest brother said, no, we can't use no Fern's names. My oldest brother's name was Joe Weldon Shin, S-H-I-N-N. The middle boy, James Lemoyne Shin. Paul, you're sitting here with Ivy Laverne Shin. I got invitation to every woman's college that was in existence. How they ever did this, I don't know, but my dad's baby brother was named Ivy, and where they got Laverne, I don't know. But we, Moyne and I, went to school without the L.A. We'd call each other Moyne and Vern. Mm-hmm. Everybody did that. So when I read this letter, they said, wanted to name him Jimmy Weldon. That's Bub's first name, second name, and Moyne's first name.
Yeah.
And I said, Jimmy Weldon, I like that name. That's what I'm going to be known as for right now. That was right in France.
You're still in the service. You're still Ivan Laverne Shin.
That's right. And then when I go into Chafe headquarters, I told these guys, I said, I've got a new name I want to use. And these fellas said, you're Jimmy Weldon for us. I was almost engaged to Muriel before she knew I wasn't Jimmy Weldon, because they said something about I'm going to America, and said, what relation is she to you? And she said, that's my husband gonna be. Because Ivy Laverne, that's got to be women. I told Mom, I said, where in the thunder you all got those names? But anyway, it's amazing. Muriel was on Little House on the Prairie 8 years. Trapper John, 5 years as a nurse. Mm-hmm. Famous. I mean, great dancer.
Yeah, you were a Hollywood couple, to be sure. But you didn't tell us the story of how you met. You told us you met her and you brought her home as a war bride, but how did you meet Muriel?
All right. I was putting on my show over there at Rainbow Corner.
Uh-huh.
And she was supplying drinks for the soldiers behind the desk. In fact, anyone that was in the entertainment industry over there, part of their work, their actual work was to entertain the soldiers or be at Rainbow Corner serving drinks and dance with them and something.
Mm-hmm.
So she was serving Cokes. She said, would you like to dance with me? And I said, I'm not a good dancer. And she said, well, I'm not either. Either like that. And so we got on the dance floor, and I said, man, you can't dance very well, can you? She said, no. Later, I go down to see where she is. She said, would you see the show I'm in? She was one of the principal dancers at the Night in the Music, the longest-running show in London, Vic Oliver's Night in the Music. He was married to Sarah Churchill, Winston's daughter.
Uh-huh.
And when I saw it, I said, good golly, there's Muriel out on that stage as one of the principal dancers. And I said, she can't dance. But anyway, we had a great life. 40 and a half years. Look, I tell people now. I said, Muriel was married to her 4.5 years, little English girl. Then she left me. They said, oh, that's an English girl. I said, oh, wait a minute. I don't know where she is. Oh, really? I said, yeah. Now tell them the story. I was in the hospital with her at St. Joseph's Hospital, crying my heart out. And she said, oh, darling, please pray to let Jesus take me now. I said, what's going to happen to me? She said, you have such a wonderful life motivating others about their future. Don't cry. I'll just be there waiting for you. And I watched her pass away right there in front of me. I tell everybody, I don't know where she is. Denver Pyle. Do you remember his name? The actor?
Mm-hmm.
I gave Muriel's memorial service. He said, you can't do this. I said, I'm the only one that can. So in our church, when he walked out, I walked over, and Denver and his wife, Tippy, were sitting over to the side. And I said, hey, Denver, why are you, Tippy, sitting way over here? And he said, Weldon, if the show's no good, I'm leaving. That was at Muriel's memorial service. We had a good time. But anyway, that's life goes on. You can't stop.
Nope. And Jimmy Weldon doesn't even sound like he's slowing down, does he? I had such a great time with this energetic 92-year-old that we're going to spend the next show with him, too. We'll hear how his career in entertainment progressed and talk more about his quest to help younger generations come to love America as much as he does. Again, check out the video and photos at hometownheroesradio.com, as well as the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And join us again next time for more from Jimmy Weldon. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.